Hey everybody, I'm back, but David and Danny are not with me today. I spent the last couple of weeks traveling around. I just had a crazy schedule, and I really want to thank Rick Carr for taking over and hosting Dummy in my stead. Today, we're going to talk with Eric Winalda. If you've been following Howler's recent Twitter activity, you know that we published a story about MLS Miami, and there are some people in Kansas City and with MLS Miami who are not very happy about that story. I promise that talking to Eric Winalda is not an attempt to further rile up the powers that be at MLS, but we have a profile of Eric in our new issue. It's by Tim Pratt. It's really good. It sort of covers the 2014 NASL season where Eric was coaching the Atlanta Silverbacks and commuting not only from California, Southern California, where he lives, but also from Europe, where he was going sort of unexpectedly to call Champions League games. He had been doing it from the studio up until that point. So I had a conversation with Eric today, long kind of wide ranging conversation. We talked about everything from the story about coaching, about his own experience in the NASL and MLS, and it gets very interesting. He's a thoughtful guy. We talk about the U.S. national team. We talk about the state of American players going to Europe, and some of his own experiences playing in the Bundesliga and whatnot. So I hope you'll listen. I hope you'll enjoy it, and I hope you will check out the story about Eric in issue 7. This is a great companion, but it does not stand in. By the way, on Twitter, before I asked Eric to come on yesterday on Twitter, he said that the story is accurate but unflattering in places, which I think is true. And it sort of, I don't know, I was glad that he could have some perspective and not be too upset. But he spoke with me a long time. It's a good conversation, and here it is.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out whoareyadesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at whoareyadesigns.com.
Eric Winalda joins me now. Eric, thank you so much for coming on to Dummy.
No problem, man.
Listen, so you know, we wrote a profile, or we published a profile about you in the newest issue. Specifically, it takes place the year, I guess the season, you could say, that you were coaching the Atlanta Silverbacks in the NASL. That was last year, 2014.
It was kind of fun because Tim was with us all the time. I mean, on one occasion, I remember he even hitched a ride with me and my kids to a practice, which was great. He got to see everything. There was really nothing that was off limits. And he was in the locker room. He was in our coaches' meetings, and he really got a true feel of the challenges that existed in, not just as a coach, but specifically with Atlanta. It was a very unique situation. I thought he did a great job. It was hard at times to stay with us because there was so much going on, but I thought that the article was fantastic, even though it did show some of the unflattering pieces of the work.
Right? I think you said fair, but unflattering, or accurate, but unflattering. But I think that, first of all, I want to commend you because it's really hard, I think, to let somebody in and give them that kind of access to your professional life and still sort of maintain the integrity and go about doing your job the way that you would if nobody were paying that close of attention to you. The fact that the season was difficult at times, that Atlanta didn't go back to the final, the NASL final as they did the year before, it was a tough season. And I think that you see a human side, and a real view into the struggles of a professional soccer team and its coach that we rarely get as fans. You know, I guess, can I start off by asking you, you know, you had coached, I think your highest profile sort of experience as a coach before this was when you took a team of mostly amateurs, I think, from Southern California and made a run deep into the U.S. Open Cup. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a ride. I mean, I think if you go back even further than that, prior to Chicago hiring Carlos de los Cobos, I was on the short list of candidates to be named the manager of the Chicago Fire, which would have been a big deal. And I think one of the, I guess the thing that really bit me when it came to my meetings with Andrew Houtman was that I just didn't have any experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, I understand how that works. I'm a guy, I'm working television. It is my job to drop everything and to make an attempt at this profession that has zero security isn't really the best move for a guy. At the time I had four kids. Now I have five. You know, one of the things that went through my mind was, you know what? I just have to prove that I can actually do this. Not just that I want to, but I've always said that when it comes to Major League Soccer, some of the guys that they hire, and I know this is going to be a controversial thing to say, but the truth is the most desperate guy wins in those battles. Whenever it comes down to the last couple of guys or candidates for an open position, the guy that says the right things in the meeting and takes the least amount of money is usually the guy that gets hired. And that's an unfortunate truth to the occupation of manager in the United States. But I took it upon myself to prove something, but I also kind of knew that I had a good group of players. And, you know, I do a lot of scouting. And at one point or another, I've worked for virtually, you know, every team in this league off the books, whether it be helping DC find Chris Pontius or, you know, whatever. There's all kinds of stuff.
Well, I think one of the things that comes through is the loyalty that some of these players really express toward you. I mean, I'm thinking about Mike Randolph and a few other players that you brought with you from that SoCal team with you to Atlanta and gave a chance really to develop their professional careers. I mean, Randolph had been a defender with the LA Galaxy, but when you brought him in to SoCal, he was out of the game. He was working in retail.
That was rough for me. Knowing Michael, knowing his character, knowing the kind of man he is, to see him kind of just give up the way he did was really saddening. And, you know, the other part of it was, you know, there was some real talent that I was really having a hard time figuring out why they didn't get picked up. I mean, one of the original Cal FC originals is Miguel Ibarra from Minnesota. And
oh, I didn't realize that. Oh,
we brought him in very early, and he was like, you know, I don't know what to do. I'm going to get drafted. And then he, ironically enough, gets drafted by Portland, and then they fired him. Amos McGee, who actually was a teammate of mine briefly, is from Minnesota, I believe, was instrumental in figuring out a home for him because he believed in his ability. But there was a bunch of guys. There was, you know, A.J. Soares, who was now went to New England, and you could even put Servando Carrasco on that list as well. We had a very interesting group of guys. Richie Menjivar, who now plays for El Salvador, the national team, Derby Carrillo. When we finally got that gang together and they played for the first time, you know, not to pick on Cal Luis Obispo, but my old friend Paul Holliker was the manager up there, or the coach at that time. And he had a number three or number four ranked team in the nation. I took my boys up there to play, and it was 6-0 at halftime. And Paul walked over to me and said, seriously, who are these guys? Where did you get these guys? And I said, a little bit everywhere. I didn't think it was going to be this good, because it really was. It was. We knew we had a special group, and we just, you know, in Southern California, we couldn't find a place where we could have a legitimate training session. So we scattered it around. A couple guys trained on their own. We had some injuries, and it was really just, it became a problem of resources more than anything else. Now, to extend the story, that really impressed Boris Chikrinka, and Andy Smith in Atlanta, and they called me and asked me to see if I could help them or maybe fix things in Atlanta. Now, Atlanta at the time was 4 wins, 29 losses, and 13 or 14 ties in the course of 2 years. It was dismal. It was bad. everybody. I mean, everybody told me, don't do it. Whatever you do, don't do it. Right, you know, right, you right, proved right, your right. point. You, it's a good vibe. Everything is fantastic. You know, they think this is such a wonderful thing that you, that these guys were able to prove how good they are. And I said, yeah, but guess what? They're still unemployed.
Well, I remember it felt like one of those Cinderella stories. You know, you see that every year you get one with the NCAA tournament, but in soccer,
correct.
It's so rare. The MLS teams come in late in the Open Cup. They're usually just, you know, the fitness, the technical level is usually superior, and it's an all MLS final. So you guys go through. Now, you know, it's funny because when you went to Atlanta, you guys had a similar run in the Open Cup. You beat an MLS team again. Sorry, two MLS teams, right? Because you went through and you beat Salt Lake, and then you beat Colorado.
We beat Salt Lake in Colorado, which was a story in itself. And I could go a whole bunch of different directions and get in trouble for my criticism of the referee on that day. But that I will go on the record as saying that was the most lopsided, worst refereed game I've ever seen in all of my years. I've never seen anything spin out of control so bad and have a guy mismanage a game and not have a clue what he was doing. And Pablo Mascherano and I both were red carded out of that game.
Right, right.
For being summoned out of our technical area by the referee. And then once we got there, he informed us, oh my God, you're out of your technical area. I'm being assessed tonight. I have to throw you out. And Pablo and I just looked at each other and we go, are you serious? Wrongly red carded one of my players who happens to be African and realized his mistake and then red carded another African player and didn't rescind the first red card.
Yeah. No. So just to cut in for a minute, the story of that game is in the piece. And it was a wacky game. There was like an hour long lightning delay.
Correct.
And then, you know, you guys went ahead and then I think Colorado equalized and then you guys went ahead again. I could be getting that part wrong.
No, we were ahead 2-0.
That's right. Okay.
And at the point where we went ahead 2-0, the referee took control of the match.
Yeah. And a bunch of people were tossed from both sides, but more from you guys. And actually, so
we had three players red carded, and I think Mark Birch was the only one.
Right. From Colorado, but then you and Pablo, but then, so when I was editing that story, I called Clint Irwin, the goalkeeper for Colorado, to say, hey, what do you remember about this? Like, I'm just trying to get some other perspective on this game. And he said, well, I don't remember a whole lot, but one thing I remember is that when Eric was red carded, there was one drunk fan left in the end of the stadium. And he was, you know, and so, and I have no idea what you guys were yelling at each other, but and he said, there's an amazing photograph. You have to find this photograph to put in the story.
Oh, I got it. Actually said to that guy?
No,
which
I
didn't know.
Yeah.
This guy was in the stands and he was just ruthless. And some of the things he was saying were completely out of line. I noticed he was sitting with his kids, you know, and he was clearly inebriated. And so when I had made my way towards the locker room, he followed me and he just was yelling and yelling. There's this famous picture of me leaning over the railing and all I'm saying to him is, whatever you do, don't drive home, get a ride. Whatever, can you hear me, dummy? And he's getting more and more furious. I think his whole point was that, you know, people call me a legend, but I'm not, I'm a loser. And
right.
And he was just so drunk and I wasn't mad at him. I was literally, I honestly was more concerned about, you know, him getting in a car. I remembered that visual of him sitting there with his children thinking,
right.
I hope this idiot is not driving tonight. And that's all that was. But it became this thing. I remember even getting an email from the ownership group in Minnesota saying, you can't get in arguments with fans. And I wrote back, yeah, you can when you're, you know, saving their life.
Yeah.
That guy was really drunk. And that whole thing, I mean, that whole game was amazing because, you know, our group came together. We finished, I think it was 37 minutes with 8 men and still figured out a way to deter an MLS side from scoring on us.
Yeah.
More than twice.
Even with the ref doing such a bad job. Now, I want to get to another part of this piece, which is, you know, and that guy calling you, you know, a nobody, someone who didn't achieve anything is, you know, obviously laughable for anybody who knows what you achieved as a as a player, I mean, you know, you were the U.S. men's national team's highest leading scorer until a guy named Landon Donovan, you know, took over. And we have a scene in the story about you and Alexi Lalas meeting as young national team guys. I think you were on the team before he was, and he was a Rutgers dude who came into the team in the early 90s. And he has a quote about you, and he says that you had, I think his words were, that beautiful arrogance that all of us who have been successful had to have. And I want to know, you know, do you think that that's the kind of thing that can serve a player really well? Something that, you know, you have to have as a player, that uber confidence that you can beat the guy you're playing against. I want to leave it there. I have a tendency to over ask questions. I want to know what you think about that. Is that something that, you know, serves you well as a player, but might be a hindrance as a coach when you have to be a little more diplomatic?
Well, it's, as a coach, I'm so different. And that's, I think Tim picked up on that is, and he got he was privy to a couple of conversations. As a player, you have to develop what's called convenient amnesia. You have to believe in yourself. If you don't have belief, you really will start second guessing your ability. Now, if you are talented and you have ability, you can't ruin it. You can't, you know, some of these guys that I coached, we're right in the middle of that process. They came off as arrogant. They came off as cocky. They, you know, prima donna seemed to be the word that a lot of people would associate with some of the players that I brought to Atlanta for various reasons. But, you know, like Efren Burgos, Junior Burgos, who now plays in Colombia, I've never been that hard on a player because I was so disappointed with the way that he was addressing his profession. And everything was an excuse, and everything had to be, you know, somebody else's fault. And I'm a very quiet coach. I listen. I ask a lot of questions because I always want to get to the root of the problem. There's always a reason why some of these guys underperform sometimes. Whether it's, you know, they're being stupid, and they're going out and they're drinking, or they're abusing their bodies, or they're not getting sleep, or not getting along with their wife or their girlfriend, or they're in trouble, or they've done something and they got a guilty conscience. There's always something. And if you sit them in there, and Tim got to be a part of those conversations to watch the real work of being a manager is figuring out, you know, what's wrong? What's wrong with you today? Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate as a player because I had managers who took the time to extract the good out of me and to, you know, to allow me to figure out a way, in my own way, to channel some of that anger and some of that arrogance. It's not something that you're proud of, but you got to channel it into something positive. And that became my coaching style, is to figure out, you know, what makes this guy tick? Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it that's going to make him better today? Forget about next week, because we don't got time for that. We have to worry about today. We got to get through the day. And some of these guys are loyal to me and whatnot. It's not because I'm this great coach and you know, but maybe I believed in them before they believed in themselves. And it's really neat. It really is a good feeling when you have a guy like Pablo Cruz, not going to go into the state that he was in when I found him, but the state that he's in now as a married family man, cares about himself, cares about responsibility, he has respect for his teammates. That's pretty cool. He did it. I'm not saying I did it. And he and I have a very special relationship, but to watch him transform himself into something that's you know, going to be a viable asset to any club, mm-hmm. and not a liability was the reason why I started doing this in the first place.
Yeah, Tim goes through some of that history in the piece, which I think is amazing. I mean, it shows sort of the way that guys who have been written off by the system, I guess, can come back and sort of, and still have something to contribute. I mean, he scored, you know, there, I don't want to ruin the piece. You know, I don't think this would, but you know, he blossoms in Atlanta in a way that's really wonderful to see.
My last game, I'll never forget this because we came in, we were playing against Edmonton. It was my last game as a coach. And I looked around the room and I was very quiet, and I took Junior Burgos and Junior Sandoval out of the game, which probably two of my best soccer players on the team. And I took them out and I put, I think it was Alex Harley in the game and Dion McCulley. Might have been Kellen Gulley that I put in that game. And the reason for that was it wasn't a soccer game. And Pablo Cruz walked past me. I said, "You all right?" And he goes, "I'm going to win this for you, coach." And I said, "Well, I hope so." I was laughing. And sure enough, 82nd minute, awesome free kick.
Free kick.
Awesome. Right? And the two guys, Sandoval and Burgos, are on the bench now in street clothes, are the first guys there. Instead of pouting and being, "I can't believe I got taken out," and blah, 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 you know, the way that they would act, and that behavior is just so annoying. But that was my greatest accomplishment, is to get those two guys to be team guys in a moment where they celebrated someone else's success and the team's goals. And that just wasn't the way they acted when they got there. And that is more important than anything else. This game is a great teacher of how to live your life sometimes. And those guys came a long way in a short time, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah, and so, and just to clarify what you mean when you said it wasn't a soccer game, there were a ton of fouls. It was a really chippy, almost dangerous game, right? So,
yeah, it was a mess. It was just a dogfight. People were kicking each other. They were spending a lot of time on the ground. That was the kind of game where you might get a reaction out of one of those two guys. We had just, unfortunately, we lived through the Chicago game where Mike McGee headbutted one of our players, and then they both got red carded, when actually Mike McGee should have been red carded, and that's it. But I knew that there might have been a reaction out of those two and frustration. Mm-hmm. So it was, in my opinion, it was a smart managerial move to get them off the field and just win the game, play the game we were in, and figure out a way to get past this one, because sometimes some of these games just go so far in the wrong direction, you have to accept the game for what it is. Throw the book out the window. There's no philosophy. There's no style of play. This is, you drop your sword, what's your B plan? That's the way these games go. And we came out on top, and I was just so happy for Pablo, because that's kind of cool when you predict your shot.
Hi, listener. I've got to be honest, this is a conversation I have not been looking forward to. You see, I've got to apologise. I feel like I've done you wrong. We've drifted apart, haven't we? It's me. I've been distant, I know. I mean, it's been 3 weeks since you and I, we've, you know, done it. Since I've told you about how great Who Are Your Designs are. So let's put that right. You and me, we've got a good thing going, and I really, really like you, and I want this to work. So why don't we log on to whoareyoudesigns.com and let's see if we can, you know, get the spark back? Oh, and don't forget to use the promo code DUMMY. You know I love it when you do that, right? Okay, that was super creepy. Sorry, back to George.
No, I told Tim that I was going to talk to you today, and I said, "Is there anything you're sort of wondering about or wanted me to ask him?" He said, "Based on your experience in Atlanta, you know, with the team there, do you have any predictions or thoughts or hopes for the MLS club that's going to start playing there in a couple of years?"
I think Atlanta is a wonderful city that will embrace the sport. They already have through the Silverbacks. You know, Carlos Bocanegra has been brought on as a technical director. Darren Eales has come from England. I know that they want to do things right. I think that they'll have the full support. But, you know, the hardest part about starting from scratch is building that team properly with the right people, that the right players that will identify with the community and still be, you know, top tier players. You can't win unless you got good personality and good players. And I think, you know, all in all, I think Atlanta will be fine. Atlanta deserves this. And this is not a slap at Boris Chikunica or Henry Harden. I have nothing bad to say about those two guys. But the constraints that we were under, I was asked to build a team with nothing. It was all on the opportunity of a light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, I'm very proud that some of these guys, you know, almost all of them are making more money, you know, now than they did when they first came to Atlanta. All of them, and that's 20 some odd players, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, you've got some guys from your team. Poku, right, was signed by NYCFC.
Correct.
A couple of guys playing in Colombia now.
Sandoval and Burgos, they went together, and they got great contracts. I'm proud of them. Pablo's making more money.
might have a scenario with Danny Barrera, who's kind of been traded twice and fallen off a little bit. And I know how what's going on there, and I know that's a very talented player that needs to be managed. And that's you know, I hope he finds his feet. I haven't spoken to him in a while, but Chris Klug was a wonderful discovery. I expect Matt Horwath to do good things this year, mm-hmm. and probably find his way into an MLS team once he figures that out. So, I think that there's, Nasco had a quick trip. I still think he's talented. I think he just got unlucky with a really unfortunate red card. But he's in Fort Lauderdale making more money than he was in Atlanta. The bottom line is we had the lowest budget in the league. By far. Mm. And it's very hard to keep those guys locked in, motivated, and believing in the cause, because you really can't go to the fan base and say, well, this guy's going to be here for 3 years. With all due respect to Atlanta Silverbacks, under those circumstances, nobody wants to be there for three. If you're still there after 3 years, right. You're doing something wrong.
Right.
So,
I mean, and you get a view of a lower sort of a team that's really closer to sort of the way that, most people live. I mean, there's a part in the story where, I think Pablo comes to you and says, hey, can I expense a cab ride from the airport for my wife and kids? Right. I mean, that's something that most players at an MLS club, I mean, and I hesitate even to say that, but it's sort of just an automatic or you can afford that. It's not a problem, right? But you're having to think about things that you don't necessarily have to think about. And I think when people think about professional athletes, professional soccer players, they don't think of these challenges as being part of their lives. But for these guys, for people playing at that level, they are.
Yeah, it really is, not just on the soccer field, but in just get through the day. And that's how these guys think sometimes. I mean, they're, bills to get paid. Who's actually going to drive today? Because there's only like five guys on the team that have cars. These are things that you don't really think about are going to be a problem until you get there. But when you understand how difficult that job actually is, I mean, I took a lot of heat from ever since people called me the Skype coach and all this stuff. What people don't know about that is that we did have a plan, and the plan didn't work out because my Fox schedule changed.
Right, you were going to Europe instead of calling games from the studio. You were traveling to Europe.
It was incredible. I mean, I was commuting from Portugal, Madrid, Munich, Manchester, and London. It wasn't a 3-hour trip anymore, and just a couple of days away. And the plan kind of had to be changed. I left the team, I think, in middle of July, and I don't know how many games they won after I left, but it didn't
get much better.
It made me feel like it really is a hard job.
Yeah.
Under those circumstances, it is a really hard job.
Let me ask you about that. I'm curious. I mean, my thinking was going into this, when the reason that I was intrigued by it in the first place, I mean, it was obviously an unconventional working setup, but I also knew that you had a history of coaching. I mean, the run through the Open Cup, but that you had been sort of named on the shortlist for some MLS clubs. I mean, I think Chivas USA was a possibility at one point, and I knew that that was something that you kind of wanted to do. I had this vague knowledge of that. And then when you got a chance with the Silverbacks, it seemed from afar like, okay, you didn't fully take it. Like you sort of decided, okay, I want to do this, but I'm going to honor the commitment I made to Fox, and I'm not going to leave that job. And like you said, you have family. It's a really volatile market. I mean, coaches have very little job security. You have to pick up and move. It's crazy. Do you ever regret not, or maybe you don't feel this way at all, but giving it your all, sort of saying, all right, I'm going to jump in with 2 feet here and actually really, really, really give everything I can to try to make this work?
Logistically, it wouldn't work. I mean, and Andy Smith will tell you this, and I probably shouldn't admit it, but all I wanted the first year in my first couple of months in Atlanta was not to lose money. So the joke between Atlanta and myself, or specifically with Andy Smith, was, hey, I lost 15 grand of my own money with this Cal FC experience. Mm-hmm. They told me, we can't pay you. We can't pay you anything. Mm-hmm. We can put you up in a hotel, but we don't really have any money, so all we got is 15 grand. Will you take it? Mm-hmm. And that's literally because the reality was that they needed to give money to a coach. When we hired Brian Haynes, he took the ball from there, and it was a low number, but we were able to get him a salary the next year when everything reset. But, you know, Chacon still, they still had to honor his contract, and no one was willing to pay two coaches at the same time. So the second year of when I took over, once they built the budget, what people also don't understand is that there was a lot of talk about this team going away completely. Mm-hmm. The ownership groups were going to, they just announced that Atlanta was going to have an MLS team. There was no money whatsoever. It would be regrettable if I would have put full seed into that and tried to make that work, simply because I would have lost my job at Fox. And again, I have five kids, a mortgage, and responsibility. There's just no way that I could let my family down like that. And especially with the tumultuous atmosphere that's out there with who MLS believes the head coach is in the first place. So I don't even think I'm in that conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a certain criteria that needs to be met. Very similar to what you just said, is that you got to dedicate yourself to it. You got to be somebody's assistant for 2 years to prove that you want to be a head coach. And regardless of whether you were watching some guy screw it up or learning something, again, to my initial point, and when an MLS job is available, the most desperate guy wins. I would even throw the likes of Owen Coyle in that scenario. He was desperate to get a job, and he got one because he probably said the right things in the meeting. Now, the rest of the managers that are scattered around the league, there's Ben Olsen in D.C. Obviously, that's a connection to the club. Jay Heaps is in New England. Jimmy Curtin is from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. That's why that works. It's all this stuff. Donovan Kinnear, he gets his homecoming in San Jose.
Well, sometimes it's not even that. I mean, even Mike Pecky, you could say would have been, I think, desperate to do his job. He loved that team. I mean, you could see that, and that's different though.
That's a whole different political ball of string that has nothing to do with Mike Pecky. Ollie Curtis came in there to change things, and I guess Montreal had finally stopped paying Jesse Marsh, and then he got the job, so he was the next in line.
Yeah.
That was about a directional change more than anything else. That, and you know, I feel bad for Pecky because I love him to death. I think he put his heart and soul into that. That's exactly what you just alluded to. Do I regret not putting my heart and soul into Atlanta to be ultimately dismissed like Pecky? That's the nature of this business. Mm-hmm. And you know, as much as you'd like to put your heart and soul into it, it's a difficult thing. I could go on and on about this kind of stuff. I mean, Jurgen Klinsmann, who's our national team manager, right? I got a question for you. I don't even know what the answer is. I'll have to look it up after we hang up. Has it ever worked out? Has anybody ever won the World Cup with a foreign manager?
Yeah, I don't believe so. I think that's actually a piece of trivia that I don't believe so. I'm trying to think back. I don't think so.
So my point is heart and soul, patriotism. When you pump your fist because your team won, why are you pumping your fist? Are you pumping your fist because the team won and they're going to stop saying bad things about you?
Mm-hmm.
Or because this is your country? And there's that national pride that comes along with a victory against another nation. It becomes a thing where it's just a job.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another job. That's a setup for your next job. That's okay sometimes at the club level, but it's an occupation that I think I'm going to wait 5 or 6 years for. Until I get a little bit more gray hair, the eyes start to go a little bit more, but hopefully I haven't lost the love for the game and just the idea that you can help players get better.
As a former player for the U.S. national team, I'm curious to get your take on this. Especially with recent games, it feels like the U.S. has done okay, but then lost it in the last couple of minutes. I mean, it seems, and I think Klinsmann was blaming a lack of fitness against Chile. I don't know if that's still the case against Denmark. I don't think it's the same players. I think it seems to be sort of an institutional problem that we're going through right now. Are you seeing anything there that the average fan might not be noticing?
I see a lot. I can't speak for someone what they don't see and what they don't, or what they do.
Right.
I would say this. I think when we get into big games during the World Cup, players like Alejandro Bedoya find himself in the lineup more than not, because those are tactical shortcomings of the manager. He's playing games. He's trying so hard not to lose
that he picks players that have the physical capacity to run all day. But what you're alluding to in these most recent games is that, and what I've started to understand about Jurgen Klinsmann is he is overdoing it. He is over coaching, over training. These guys need, it's not a vacation when you go to your national team, but you need a break. Everything goes into the quantum leap with Jurgen Klinsmann. And I understand where he's coming from. If you do it on a calendar year, I don't think he has the players more than 100 days out of a calendar year, which means he's got a little over 2/3 of the time to think and to plan. So what happens is when these guys come into camp, he wants to cram it all in into 4 days. What I'm seeing is a team that's extremely tired physically and mentally at the end of games. Not that they don't have it or they would have had it, but I think the travel and the early morning wake up and these, you know, empty stomach jogs at 7 a.m. before a training at 9:30 is a little bit too much. But Jurgen Klinsmann has a history with this. I mean, he arrived at Bayern Munich and actually with the German national team and tried to remove Dr. Müller Wohlfahrt. First things, right out of the chute, just, I'm going to remove one of the most world-renowned doctors on the planet because he had different ideas about the physical training, which was, you know, it's not broken, don't fix it, but that's, and it's exactly what he did upon arrival with the U.S. national team. Dr. Bert Mandelbaum, Howard Lieberskind, they were all dismissed, all of them. You know, when Real Madrid comes to L.A., they call Howard Lieberskind for a foot doctor, but he's still not good enough for our national team anymore. The letter that was sent to MLS teams basically stated, we want to do a test, okay, several tests, a fitness test for the players that might be called into the U-23s and the national team. I think don't quote me on this, but I've heard that there's also been blood work and mineral intake tests that were. Now these were at the expense of the club, but basically Jurgen is, by writing this letter and sending it to all the MLS teams, is telling each one of these franchises that all the people that you employ, your doctors, your physicians, your trainers, you don't know what you're doing.
Right, right.
I'll take it from here. I'm pretty sure Jurgen Klinsmann is not a doctor. And I'm pretty sure physicians and all the doctors that I've met over the years don't like to be told medicine by somebody who doesn't have a medical degree, but that's essentially what he's doing. Huh. So when you look at the performance yesterday, for example, those are tired minds and tired bodies. Tired is different than fit. They don't have a fitness problem. They have a tired problem. Mm-hmm. That's all that was. And I'm out of line. Maybe my 106 times for my country aren't worth anything, but I know when you come and play for your country, you're usually not unfit at this point.
Right, right, right.
But if the coach and the managers don't handle the time well and give these guys appropriate rest, that's the kind of performance you get.
So let me ask you one other thing about sort of a trend that I'm seeing. I mean, everyone's noticed this. I'm not unique. But, you know, we have very few Americans playing in Europe these days. I mean, especially relative to, you know, at certain points in the last 10, 15 years, you were one of the first Americans to really go and make a name for yourself in the Bundesliga. How do you view this? I mean, is this something we, you know, fans should be concerned about? Is it, you know, I think people look at success in Europe as a validation of American soccer, but we're not getting that these days.
Well, that's not trying to correct you here, but I was the first in the Bundesliga.
Yes. Okay.
So
sorry, I wasn't sure if you were Paul Caligiuri was the first.
Paul was second division. He played at Meppen. He was actually helped me write my contract. I drove all the way to his house in Fullerton and he told me what to ask for.
did you get it?
But yeah, no, it was pretty much exactly the way he said it. Paul said, great guy. But look, when the landscape has changed so much from my time in Europe, in the early 90s, I played in the German Bundesliga. I was the first American to go there. This is coming off the heels of them being world champions. I think Lothar Matthäus and Jürgen Puller, Sommer, Hassler, I mean, Lipowski, Augenthaler, I mean, pretty amazing players. Going into that scenario was very difficult because back then there was no Bosman ruling. Only three foreigners could play.
Right.
The rest had to be German, which was actually a very different setup than the way it works now. If you're European, you're in the European community, you can, you don't count on that number as a foreigner. So
looking at the perception of reality versus the reality of the situation, the bottom line is, if you're playing at a high level, right, and you're playing all the time, let's say a lower tier German team, very similar to what Michael Bradley had with Gladbach before Gladbach got good, it's a tough deal because the games aren't, they're all about points. There's no style to them. There's no philosophy. This is just, you know, there's so much different about it that you learn more about character in games like that than you learn about, you know, talent. But if the talent's there, it'll always surface. Good players always find a way. We spend so much time worrying about these things, but I think we beat our players up too much. I think we got to find the talented ones and allow them to express themselves a little bit more. Our team right now is having a hard time with personality. I'm sorry, I got bored at halftime. I was bored. I just didn't get to see. I don't when I watch my national team, I want to see these guys. I want to celebrate their time.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're saying that when you see the team, you want to see some personality. You want to see some. I mean, and you guys, the team that I think people love and fell in love with, you know, that one of the first big waves. I mean, let's, you know, set aside 1990, but the 94 team had personality out the wazoo. I mean, you got Kobe Jones, you got yourself, you got Alexi, people who you could just look at and see, okay, yeah, those people, they, you know, Tony Meola, they have, there's some characters on that team.
Yeah, and look, I think when you go back to 94, I would even say 95 is probably a better representation of...
That's the Argentina year, I think?
Yeah, I mean, it was Argentina. We beat Mexico. We had some pretty big results in there. But I think personality to me is the missing piece. When we see our country play, when I see the United States play, I want to celebrate it. I want to celebrate their opportunity because it's different. You know, I'm 45 years old. I'm 15, 20 years removed from memories that are always going to stay with me. And those are the ones that you want these guys to live. You want them to take advantage of these opportunities to play, but not to skate out of them, not to just get through the game or be afraid to make a mistake. I mean, good, bad, or indifferent. Show us who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm pretty sure we can all trap and pass the ball, but being afraid to try stuff and being afraid to try and change the game, turn it on its head. Some of these guys have those abilities, but how many times does the ball get in the corner in a one-on-one situation and you hear from the bench and you see these guys say, hold the ball. No. What do you mean hold the ball? That guy's standing in front of you. Beat him.
Yeah.
And if you guys are tired, then catch up. I mean, my attitude towards that, and my teammates learned in a hurry, if I ever got on the wing, I don't care how tired I was going to take that guy on. If it was a one-on-one situation, and after about four or five months, those guys figured out, oh, he ain't passing it. He's taking this thing to the line, and we're probably better served if we get our butts in front of the goal because we might get something out of it. And that attitude is gone. Fab Ramos used to get the ball and we'd all smile. We'd all just go, this is going to be good. If the ball came through our midfield and somebody started to get a little cute with it on the opposition, Tom Dooley handled it. I mean, handled it. It was beautiful. As ugly as it was beautiful. To know that guy got up slow and said, well, I'm not going to do that again. Where's the meanness? Where's the aggression? And where's the flair? You know, that's... And all I think this takes, in my opinion, is a little bit of stop talking so much about the things that we're doing wrong. I just have some quiet meetings with a couple of guys and say, come on, man, you're better than this. Let's see it. Show me what you got. I'm not going to pull you out. I'm not going to pull you out. You lose the ball five times, so what? The sixth time might work out. Let's go. Those conversations, I just don't feel like they're happening anymore. I feel like there's an obsession and possession thing going on, and everybody's so afraid to make a mistake, and, you know, so everybody just ends up doing nothing. And I'll be honest, I got bored. I turned it off at halftime.
Brings us back nicely, I think, to the first part of our conversation where we talked about, you know, motivating players, being a coach. Eric, I want to thank you for coming on and joining me. It was really, really interesting to talk to you, and just thanks for your time.
You bet, man. Anytime.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com.